in high school, putting together the yearbook layout. Ian said the essay was postmodern and smart, but he had a difficult time explaining it to me. I suggested he try again, that he go for something coherent and smart, something with an obvious narrative arc. Ian resisted this idea, imagining a boring essay that mirrored his resume. This was a problem because while schools and companies want originality and creativity, they want communication and reasoning even more. No matter what company or program someone applies to, a sort of game goes on. Interviewers want to hear a reasonable story about the past, present, and future. How does what you did before relate to what you want to do now, and how might that get you to what you want to do next? Everyone realizes most applicants don't actually know what their careers will look like. Even the ones who think they do often change their minds. As a human resources executive told me, I don't expect people to say it's their dream to work here forever. I roll my eyes at that. No one knows where they will be in 5 years. Still, the burden is on the applicants to show that working here makes sense beyond the person just wanting a job or the building being 2 blocks from their apartment. Life does not need to be linear, but it does, as this executive said, need to make sense. Ian, you're doing it again, I said. You're muddling your story because you don't want to commit to anything, much less to anything that makes sense. That makes you sound cagey or chaotic. No one will hire you with a story like that. But I don't want to pin myself down, he said. To what? Your story isn't a contract. You won't be asked to sign it in blood. It's an introduction. Reluctantly, Ian created a sharper narrative, one that started with his early interest in drawing. He pulled together his relevant experiences in architecture and cognitive science classes and a bit about his work. In the opening sentence of the new essay, Ian recalled a time from childhood when he carried around a little spiral flip notebook because he liked to make small abstract pictures for his parents and siblings. His family called him Mr. Logo. With the same capital and a better story, Ian went to work at the company in D.C. A few years later, when he was at another choice point in his life, he wrote this. When I made the decision to come to D.C., I worried that by making that choice, I was closing all the other doors open to me at that moment. But it was sort of liberating to make a choice about something, finally. And if anything, this job has just opened more doors for me. Now I feel really confident that I will have several iterations of my career, or at least time for several iterations, and that I will be able to do other things in life. For a long time, it was such a relief to have this job. I felt like I could just live my life and not worry about direction, worries that immobilized me in the years after I graduated. Now I'm at a point where I don't want to continue in my current position, and I'm pissed. It's hard to think all over again about what the next step is, but it's easier now because I know from experience that I have to take action, that debating isn't going to get me anywhere. Sometimes making choices feels like planning for my life in a way that seems boring. Sometimes making choices to pursue things that seem like good fits or that match my interests seems boring simply because it makes sense. I find myself wanting to go off in an unexpected direction, Arabic, Cambodia. I know this is a sort of crazy impulse. I know that the way to live a good life is to pursue things that are not only interesting to you, but that make sense. Above all else in my life, I feared being ordinary. Now I guess you could say I had a revelation of the day-to-day. I finally got it. There's a reason everybody in the world lives this way, or at least starts out this way, because this is how it's done. Ian was right. This is how it's done. This is how it starts. Claiming a career or getting a good job isn't the end. It's the beginning. And then there is still a lot more to know and a lot more to do. Love. An upmarket conversation. Society is structured to distract people from the decisions that have a huge impact on happiness in order to focus attention on the decisions that have a marginal impact on happiness. The most important decision any of us make is who we marry. Yet there are no courses on how to choose a spouse. David Brooks, political and cultural commentator. In 2009, David Brooks, a columnist for the New York Times, wrote an article about being asked to give a commencement speech. In the piece, he said he had writer's block. He said he felt he wasn't supposed to say what he really wanted to say, which was something about how happiness has more to do with whom you marry than with what college you attend. He opined that while universities offer countless classes on semiotics, there is not a single course on being smart about marriage, and that this is the chief way our society is messed up. Brooks aptly observed that we have to go down market to talk shows or reality shows to hear marriage discussed at all. I don't know if Mr. Brooks talked about getting married when he gave the commencement address, but I can imagine the horror and alienation among the graduates if he had. I can see hundreds of baccalaureates standing there in cap and gown, mouths agape, wondering what exactly marriage had to do with them. At that moment, probably very little. Today's 20-somethings spend more time single than any generation in history. Most will spend years on their own, somewhere between their childhood homes and families of their own. This gives many people a chance to live it up before they settle down and to have fun with friends and lovers while the options are open. Some people find each other through friends, while others connect online or around town. Some are serial monogamous, while others pair with as many people as they can. Pundits and parents worry that marriage is dead, dating is in demise, and hooking up is the new relational medium. But the moratorium on marriage is relative. Young Americans do marry later than their parents did, on average about 5 years later, and this statistic especially holds in urban areas. Currently, the average age for first marriage is 26 for women and 28 for men, with more than half of adults marrying over the age of 25. But the United States is still the most marrying nation in the Western world. About 50% of Americans marry by age 30, 75% by the age of 35, and 85% by the age of 40. Even though marriage may seem almost irrelevant, most 20-somethings, male or female, gay or straight, will be married or partnered or dating their future partner within about 10 years' time. As passé or postponed as marriage or partnership may seem, what is even less in vogue is talking about it. Popular magazines portray a 20-something culture dominated by singles who are almost obsessed with avoiding commitment. But behind closed doors, I hear a different story. I have yet to meet a 20-something who doesn't want to get married or at least find a committed relationship. The clients with fast-paced lives or high-profile jobs just feel compelled to whisper about it and hope for the best. It seems too conventional, or at least politically incorrect, to be strategic about such things. Even clients who desperately want to be married seem embarrassed or even superstitious about staking claim to any particular relational dream. We seem to believe that relationships are completely out of our control. Career, on the other hand, is what we can plan for. Specificity of professional desire is admired among many, and we spend years gaining mastery over our work lives. Guidance counselors help us plot our high school trajectories. Educational consultants charge as much as $30,000 to help kids prepare college applications. Test prep companies offer courses and private tutors for college or graduate entrance exams. Major advisors help us figure out what path to take in college and graduate school. Internship placement services can cost thousands of dollars. Business degrees guarantee access to network databases. Doctoral-level degrees ensure expertise. As we build a career, it seems there is a book, class, degree, consultant, or service available at every turn. Maybe that's as it should be, because careers are important. But along the way, because of these very choice points, there is so much room for revision that developing your career in no way compares to choosing a partner or spouse. Maybe this was what David Brooks meant when he said that whom you marry is the most important decision in your life. Marriage is one of our most defining moments because so much is wrapped up in it. If building a career is like spending 12 hours at the blackjack table, seeing the cards as you make your decisions, playing each hand with current winnings in mind, having a new opportunity to take a chance or play it safe with every card dealt, then choosing a mate is like walking over to the roulette wheel and putting all your chips on red 32. With one decision, you choose your partner in all adult things. Money, work, lifestyle, family, health, leisure, retirement, and even death become a three-legged race. Almost every aspect of your life will be intertwined with almost every aspect of your partner's life. And let's face it, if things don't work out, a marriage cannot just be left off a resume like a failed job. Even as a divorced couple, you may be forever tied, financially and logistically, as you pay for schools and meet every other weekend in the driveway to exchange the kids. Most 20-somethings are painfully aware of the significance of marriage. If remarriage is the triumph of hope over experience, then, as researcher Jeffrey Arnett observes, even a first marriage for many 20-somethings is a victory. Half of today's 20-somethings have been left in the wake of divorce, and all know someone who was. In the 20th century, it was tempting to minimize the effects of divorce. Some adults in unhappy marriages imagined trickle-down happiness. They would be happier after divorce, therefore, so would their kids. But as these kids matured, the unexpected legacy of divorce was undeniable. Many children of divorce said they had not much noticed or cared whether their parents were happily married. What they did know was that their lives fell apart after their parents split, as resources and parents became stretched too thin. So while we hear a lot about 20-somethings who just want to have fun before marriage, many are also waiting to commit in hopes of being luckier in love than their parents were. But doing something later is not necessarily the same as doing something better. This may explain why, even as the average age of marriage rises, the divorce rate holds steady at about 40%. More and more 20-somethings are careful not to rush into marriage at a young age, yet many do not know what else to consider. The timeline has changed, but a new conversation has not yet begun. One of the first big research projects I worked on as a graduate student was a study that followed about 100 women from their 20s into their 70s. At midlife, each woman was asked to write one page about her most difficult life experience so far. Some stories were about tough bosses or unrequited love, a few were about tragic illnesses, but many of the saddest, most protracted stories were about bad marriages. Some had ended in divorce and others were continuing on. The women in this study were 21 in the early 1960s, and 80% of them were married by 25. When I worked on this research, I was in my late 20s and unmarried. I remember feeling relieved that my generation had the luxury of marrying later. I was sure that my cohort and those who followed would have happier marriages because we got to explore before we settled down. Now I know that postponing marriage, in and of itself, does not make for a better union. The trend toward later marriages is a relatively new one, so scientists are only beginning to measure and understand what it means for couples. It is well established that teen marriages are the most unstable of all unions, and this, coupled with what we now know about the maturation that goes on in one's 20s, has led many to believe that when it comes to marriage, the later, the better. This is not exactly what researchers are finding. The most recent studies show that marrying later than the teen years does indeed protect against divorce, but this only holds true until about age 25. After 25, one's age at marriage does not predict divorce. These findings run counter to the notion that it is unquestionably better to postpone marriage as long as you can. Older spouses may be more mature, but later marriage has its own challenges. Rather than growing together while their 20-something selves are still forming, partners who marry older may be more set in their ways, and a series of low-commitment, possibly destructive relationships can create bad habits and erode faith in love. And even though searching may help you find a better partner, the pool of available singles shallows over time, perhaps in more ways than one. These are all real considerations, but the challenge I hear about most in my practice is related to what has been termed the age 30 deadline. The age 30 deadline is the quiet but nagging concern that so many 20-somethings have. What to do about relationships in our 20s may not be clear or even seem imminently important, but I'd better not be alone at 30 is a common refrain. At 30, this nagging concern crawls out of its corner and becomes full-blown panic. The exact timing and pitch of the age pressure varies depending on where someone lives and what their peers are doing. And women can feel more stress around this than men because they may have less time to start a family and they may feel they have less power as they imagine sitting around waiting for a ring. In my experience, the age 30 deadline is more of an age 30 bait and switch. Everything that was okay at 29 suddenly feels awful, and in an instant we feel behind. Almost overnight, commitment changes from being something for later to being something for yesterday. Marriage goes from being something we'll worry about at 30 to being something we want at 30. When, then, is the time to really think about partnership? This sudden shift can lead to all kinds of trouble. Let's compare the sorts of things I hear from those in their 20s and 30s. This is what 20-somethings say. I don't think a lot about who I date. If the person is fun to talk to and there's good sex, that's enough. What more is there to worry about? I'm only 27. I love my girlfriend. We've been together 3 years. But I'm not planning on factoring her into where I go to graduate school. I'm just not supposed to be thinking about this in my mid-20s. I imagine this would all come a lot later. I want to get married by 28 and have my first child by 31, but I feel silly when I say that to people. There's this stigma that you can't really plan for that kind of stuff. Feels like I'm 14 again and playing pretend house. My boyfriend tells me he wants to own a home by the age of 35. During another conversation, I told him I want to have my first baby when I'm 30 to 32. He told me it's not realistic to decide when to have a baby. That's going to depend on where we are in our careers, how much money we have, where we live. So how can he say he plans to buy a home by a certain age? It's like a double standard, and it seems like it's easier and more realistic to plan our careers and financial stability than to plan our marriages and babies. My boyfriend and I got together because we were both heading west. We moved in together when we got here because it was easier. We both like kayaking and all that, but we're not serious. I'd never marry him. I love my boyfriend, and I can only say this to you. I want to marry him. But I feel like I'm not allowed to want that at this point in my life. So we keep taking these breaks to date other people, and then we end up talking all the time and getting back together. It's like neither one of us thinks we can say you're it. Like there's something wrong with that. So many of my 20-something clients either don't take their relationship seriously or don't think they are allowed to. Then somewhere around 30, getting married suddenly seems pressing. Now listen in on my 30-something clients, some of whom are only a year or two older than the clients we just heard from. Every time somebody on Facebook changes their status to engaged or married, I panic. I'm convinced Facebook was invented to make single people feel bad about their lives. My dad always says, don't turn out like Aunt Betty. She's single. Whenever my boyfriend goes out of town and we don't see each other for a weekend, or God forbid, a week, I think that's just 1 week later until we get engaged. I want to lock this thing down now. I'm not going to be that balding guy at the bars whose friends have all moved on. My boyfriend put a ring box under the Christmas tree last year. It wasn't an engagement ring. I'm still mad about it. Friday and Saturday nights are all right until all the couples start getting their coats. I try to leave before that happens because it feels crappy being one of the leftover people. Next week is my birthday and I don't even want to celebrate it. It might get my boyfriend thinking about whether I have old eggs. Anything I do where I'm not meeting my husband is a total waste of time. The best boyfriend I ever had was when I was in my mid-20s. I just didn't think I was supposed to be with someone then. Now I feel like I miss the ones who were willing to settle down, and I'm scrambling to marry whoever I can. This client perhaps best summarizes the dangers that surround the age 30 bait and switch. Dating for me in my 20s was like this musical chairs thing. Everybody was running around and having fun. Then I hit 30, and it was like the music stopped and everybody started sitting down. I didn't want to be the only one left without a chair. Sometimes I think I married my husband just because he was the closest chair to me at 30. Sometimes I think I should have just waited for someone who might be a better partner, and maybe I should have, but that seemed risky. What I really wish I'd done is thought more about marriage sooner, like when I was in my 20s. These chapters aren't about whether 30-something should sit down in the closest chair or whether they should keep looking, whether 30-something should settle or be picky. Those articles and books have been written. That debate is raging on. The chapters ahead are about 20-something men and women not settling. Not settling for spending their 20s on no-criteria or low-criteria relationships that likely have little hope or intention of succeeding. These chapters are about not waiting to get picky until you are in your 30s and the save-the-dates start pouring in. They are about being choosy about the right things when you can still think clearly about claiming your life. Besides, like with work, good relationships don't just appear when we're ready. It may take a few thoughtful tries before we know what love and commitment really are. Around the time I was a 20-something doing research on the stories about difficult marriages, I saw my first psychotherapy client, a 26-year-old named Alex. When Alex was assigned to me, I felt relieved. I hadn't been a graduate student long enough to be an expert in anything, but the 20s I thought I could handle. Alex didn't meet the criteria for any disorder, and with the funny stories she brought to her sessions, it was easy for me to nod my head while we kicked the can down the road. But it was my job to take Alex's 20-something life seriously. I just didn't know it yet. My supervisor informed me that the nodding therapists we see on television are stereotypes, and that if I wanted to be helpful, I needed to be less patient. This was good news because I am an impatient person, but I didn't know what to be less patient about. Hadn't my supervisor heard? Work happened later, marriage happened later, kids happened later, even death happened later. 20-somethings like Alex and me had nothing but time. To me, Alex's 20s seemed difficult, but kind of, well, trivial. The way I saw it, her real life hadn't started yet. She was job-hopping and hooking up with men. She wasn't raising kids or preparing for tenure. When my supervisor pushed me to take up Alex's current relationship, I protested. Sure, she's dating down, but it's not like she's marrying the guy. Then my supervisor said, not yet, but she might marry the next one. Regardless, the best time to work on Alex's marriage is before she has one. She had me there. Picking your family. Other things may change us, but we start and end with family. Anthony Brandt, author. In the world of mental health, the lowest functioning clients and highest functioning clients receive the worst care. The lowest functioning clients typically struggle with serious mental illnesses that are maintained more than cured. And because of downward drift that draws a disproportionate number of such patients into the lower income brackets, these clients often do not have access to top-notch care. The highest functioning clients, on the other hand, usually have a lot going for them. These high functioning clients are what therapists call YAVIS. Young, attractive, verbal, intelligent, and successful. And these qualities bestow all sorts of social and psychological advantages. Being young means, as a colleague once put it, that you haven't completely screwed up your life yet. Being verbal allows you to easily exchange a common currency with friends and bosses as you parlay being talkative into social status. Intelligence aids achievement in problem solving and even leadership. Successful people are generally brimming with confidence. And as Aristotle said, beauty is a greater recommendation than any letter of introduction. So, YAVIS clients are well-received nearly everywhere they go, and many therapists light up when one comes walking in the door. Still, there are two paths to being smart and charming when you are young. Life has been good, or life has been bad. When life has been good, maybe someone goes to see a therapist for a while because some isolated thing is not currently going well. Most likely, the difficulty will be resolved quickly, and the client will be on his way. When life has been bad, someone goes to see a therapist because even though things look pretty on the outside, they feel horrible on the inside, and this is a discrepancy that even many therapists cannot hold. Sometimes it is just too jarring to imagine that someone who seems so perfect has lived a life that has been so imperfect. What results is a therapy where the client's image gets in the way of the help that he or she needs. The client has come to focus on what has not gone well, but the therapist is blinded by what has. Too often, being successful when you are young is about survival. Some people are good at hiding their troubles. They are good at falling up. Emma was one of these people. She grew up in a family perched on the fragile edge of the middle class. Early childhood went well enough, but then, as happens in more families than you might imagine, things quickly declined. Her father ran up credit card debt. Her mother's social drinking turned into alcoholism. Her father lost his job and turned to suicide. Emma moved through school and friends like nothing had changed, but her interior was infused with sadness. I liked Emma immediately, which is not surprising, since resilient people are usually very likable. For years, she had been presenting herself as a vanilla 20-something. She had been spoon-feeding the world these subtly pleasing tastes of herself. She got along with everybody. She was good at most things. She went with everything. Her early therapy sessions were equally as palatable. She came on time and often began the hour by asking how I was. One day, Emma mixed up the time of her session, arriving an hour early. I had an appointment with another client, so Emma had to stay in the waiting room until it was her turn. When she came into my office, she nervously said, "I'm camping out in your waiting room. You must think I've got some serious problems." I smiled and said, "You tell me." Emma slumped over in her chair and broke into tears. When she raised her head, she was ready to talk. She said, "I feel like the loneliest person in the whole world." I liked her even more after that. Emma had fallen so far up that she felt she lived the life of an imposter. She excelled at her top-tier school, but felt like an outsider who didn't belong. Her family life was nothing like what everyone else described about their own, so she kept any real details about herself to herself. Only in my office did her past and her present collide, and for a couple of years I listened to what Emma had been through and what she was still going through. Emma graduated with honors, and when other kids' families swooped into town with bouquets of flowers and dinner reservations, she skipped the ceremonies and left the state for a good job. I was happy and sad for her at the same time. A couple of years later, Emma moved back to her old college town, and we continued our work together. She now faced what it was like to be a nearly orphaned 20-something who still had a lot of life ahead. She was exhausted, but she had some good friends. "You can't pick your family, but you can pick your friends," she said cheerfully, yet unconvincingly. Emma's friends were very kind. "I'm here for you, and you can be part of my family," they chimed. But as only a child without a family of her own knows, it's not the same. Friends can do long talks and good cries, but at holiday time or very hard times, everyone teamed up with family, and Emma was left standing alone. One day she hung her head in her lap and sobbed most of the hour. She had just bought a new address book, and she came undone as she filled in her many contacts but stared at the empty, "In case of emergency, please call blank." She was almost hysterical when she looked at me and said, "Who's going to be there for me if I have a car wreck? Who's going to help me if I get cancer?" It took every bit of professional restraint I had not to say, "I will," but that would have been about making myself feel better. Instead, I gave her my sincere attention and said, "We need to get you a new family." In her mid-20s by this point, Emma had been dating the same man for almost a year. I knew a lot about her career, but not much about him. I'd hear, "It's fine, he's fun, we have a good time." For a young woman who felt so alone, this seemed a woefully inadequate relationship, or at least a woefully inadequate description, so I pressed for more. I found out her boyfriend didn't talk a lot. He watched a lot of TV and hated working. He could be jealous and would scream at her. I didn't like what I heard at all, and I told Emma so. "How can you be so ambitious about work, but so unambitious about relationships?" I asked. "I have to have a really good job to survive," she said. "But a really good relationship is more than I can hope for. It's more than I can do anything about anyway." "No, it's not," I said. Often the clients with the toughest family backgrounds know the least about how to get what they want in love. But these are the clients who need to be the most careful. They are the very clients who need to partner well. Emma came to my office one Monday. She'd spent the weekend meeting her boyfriend's parents for the first time. Both nights she cried into her pillow and missed her previous boyfriend. This surprised me, because Emma and her former boyfriend had mostly made each other miserable. But I also remembered she had loved his family a great deal. They spent wonderful holidays together and enjoyed the little things like movies and dinners and reading the paper. I asked for more details about what it was like to be with her current boyfriend's family. The father was an astronomer who spent most of the time outside on his telescope while the mother watched TV. Neither parent was particularly interested in their son or Emma. This gave me pause. "Emma, you say you can't pick your family, but you can pick your friends. That was true growing up. Now you're about to pick your family, and I'm concerned you're not making a good choice." Emma's eyes welled up with tears, and she stared out my office window. "I can't expect my boyfriend's parents to be perfect. Mine aren't. You're right. No family is perfect. But your tears after meeting these parents, I think they are telling us something. Yeah, I'm not psyched about my boyfriend's family. You can keep learning to live with the fact that family will never envelop you. Maybe creating that for your own children will be enough. But it is hard work, spending a lifetime giving something you never get. When you partner with someone, you have a second chance at family. Emma started to have an ambition for her family. She dreamed of a caring and capable husband and two or three kids. She even allowed herself to envision in-laws who would be loving and involved grandparents. She hoped for beach vacations with three generations digging in the sand. Emma had the define the relationship talk with her boyfriend. At 30, he wasn't sure he would ever want children, and he imagined spending as little time as possible with his extended family or anyone else's. He didn't want family to get in the way of the things he still wanted to do. Emma ended their relationship. She laughed it off, saying her life had become an Onion headline she had seen. Weekend with boyfriend's parents explains a lot. I knew she was scared. There is something scary about picking your family. It's not romantic. It means you aren't just waiting for your soulmate to arrive. It means you know you are making decisions that will affect the rest of your life. It means you are thinking about the fact that your relationship needs to work not only in the here and now, but also in the there and then. 20-somethings who aren't at least a little scared about their relationships are often the ones who are being the least thoughtful. I wasn't exactly glad Emma was scared, but I knew her fear was useful. It meant she was taking love as seriously as she had always taken work. When people meet my two children for the first time, they sometimes say, "King's choice." This is because I happen to have a boy and a girl, so if I were a king, I would have a son to carry on the empire and a daughter to marry off to a neighboring country where I hope to gain favor. It is strange to have that image invoked about two 21st century children who will likely grow up and lead their lives as they choose. Plus, I bristle a little at the thought of my daughter's wedding being a business deal. But the expression also reminds me that, for many centuries, marriage was about bridging families. Today, we see marriage as a commitment between two individuals. Western culture is generally individualistic, prizing independence and self-fulfillment in almost all areas. We emphasize rights over duties and choice over obligation. This extends especially to marriage. With some notable exceptions, there has never been more freedom to decide whether, when, and how to partner, and with whom. There is no question that this has led to countless happy unions, as well as the experience of owning one of the most important decisions of our lives. At the same time, the foregrounding of the individual in relationships has caused us to forget about one of our greatest 20-something opportunities, picking and creating our families. Clients like Emma feel destined for unhappiness because of broken families. They grew up believing that family was beyond their control or something other people got to have. The only solution they have ever known has been to turn to friends or therapists or boyfriends for moments of solace, or to swear off family altogether. What no one tells 20-somethings like Emma is that finally and suddenly they can pick their own families, they can create their own families, and these are the families that life will be about. These are the families that will define the decades ahead. Emma left town for a bigger city and another good job. She got serious about family. She set her mind to making for herself what had been missing all her life. About 3 years later, Emma married someone who gave her that second chance at family. She and her husband sound happy together and are enjoying the one young child they have so far. Emma writes that her in-laws bought an apartment in their town so they could help with the grandkids and be a regular part of their lives. Her two sisters-in-law live nearby and have been there for fun dinners and beach vacations. Now she notices emergency contact blanks don't seem big enough. The cohabitation effect. Making the best of things is a damn poor way of dealing with them. My life has been a series of escapes from that quicksand. Rose Wilder Lane, writer. At 32, Jennifer's parents threw her a lavish wine country wedding, complete with pink tulips and great music. By then, Jennifer and Carter had lived together more than 3 years. The event was attended by their friends, families, and two dogs. When Jennifer started therapy with me about 6 months later, she was finishing her thank you notes and looking for a divorce lawyer. Carter was already couch surfing elsewhere, so it was a matter of days until everyone heard about the split. Jennifer said she felt like a fraud. "I spent more time planning the wedding than I spent happily married," she sobbed. Jennifer always looked halfway between a business meeting and a hangover. She dressed smartly, but often seemed tired and disheveled. She had gone to a top 10 school and was starting to have the career in public relations to prove it, but she also still partied with relative abandon. Carter was a job hopper without a professional identity. Rather than completing his last year of college, he'd gone on tour with his bluegrass band. The band fizzled, but his love for music continued. He worked here and there as a sound engineer and band promoter. Jennifer and Carter were, perhaps, the coolest, hippest couple in their crowd. They loved talking about what shows to see next. After the wedding, conversations changed. A real estate agent sat them down for mortgage calculations. Factoring in a baby made their financial outlook worse. Jennifer hoped to work part-time while her kids were small, so soon she would need Carter to earn much more money. She started to think about living back in New Hampshire, where things would be cheaper and her parents could help. Carter wanted to stay where they were, maybe for good. Their fun-filled life became a somber stalemate. What was most disheartening to Jennifer was she felt she tried to do everything right. "My parents got married young. They dated for like 6 months, and I know my mom never even had sex before she got married. How are they supposed to know if it was going to work? Carter and I were older. We lived together for like 3 years. How did this happen?" she cried into a tissue. In psychotherapy, there's a saying that the slower you go, the faster you get there. Sometimes the best way to help people is to slow them down long enough to examine their own thinking. Everyone has gaps in their reasoning. If you stop and shine a light on these mental ellipses, you find assumptions that drive behavior without our being aware of them. As Jennifer spoke, one assumption was easy to spot. Living together is a good test for marriage. This is a common misperception. Cohabitation in the United States has increased more than 1,500% in the last 50 years. In 1960, about 500,000 unmarried couples lived together. Now the number is almost 8 million. About half of 20-somethings will live with a romantic partner at least once during their 20-something years. More than half of all marriages will be preceded by cohabitation. This shift has largely been attributed to the sexual revolution and the availability of birth control, and certainly the economics of young adulthood play a role. But when you talk to 20-somethings themselves, you hear about something else. Cohabitation as prophylaxis. In a representative nationwide survey, nearly half of 20-somethings agreed with the statement, "You would only marry someone if he or she agreed to live together with you first, so that you could find out whether you really got along." About two-thirds of 20-somethings believe that moving in together before marriage is a good way to avoid divorce. Jennifer was in this group. She imagined that unlike her own divorced parents who married young and fast, she would be more successful if she waited to get married and if she lived with her partner first. But couples who live together first are actually less satisfied with their marriages and more likely to divorce than couples who do not. This is what sociologists call the cohabitation effect. The cohabitation effect has baffled many marital researchers. Some have fallen back on the explanation that those who cohabitate may be less conventional and more open to divorce in the first place. But research shows that the cohabitation effect is not fully explained by individual characteristics, such as religion, education, or politics. Similarly, in my private practice, it is not the case that liberals cohabitate and conservatives do not. In fact, the trend toward cohabitation is continuing in both red and blue states, just as it has in every other Western nation. So what accounts for the cohabitation effect? Why are couples who cohabitate more likely to wind up divorced? The latest research suggests it is something about cohabitation itself. Sliding, not deciding. Jennifer and I worked to answer her question of, how did this happen? Over many sessions, we talked about how she and Carter went from dating to living together. Consistent with studies that report most couples say it just happened, Jennifer said, "It was just easier. We were paying two rents and sleeping over at each other's places a lot. I was always leaving something I needed for work at one apartment or another. We liked to be together a lot, so it was just cheaper and more convenient. Living together was a quick decision, but if it didn't work out, there was a quick exit." Jennifer was talking about what is known as sliding, not deciding. Moving from dating to sleeping over a lot, to cohabitation, can be a gradual slope, one not marked by rings or ceremonies or sometimes even a conversation. Couples often bypass talking about why they want to live together and what it will mean. When researchers ask 20-somethings these questions, women are more likely to say they want better access to love, while men say they want easier access to sex. It is not uncommon for two partners to have different, unspoken, even unconscious agendas for cohabitation. But both men and women agree that their standards for a live-in partner are lower than for a spouse. I asked Jennifer if she slid into moving with Carter, if she was less intentional about moving in together than she would have been about engagement or marriage. That was the point, she said. It wasn't marriage, so thinking it through wasn't supposed to matter. What if you think about it now? I think my criteria were good sex, fun weekends, cool crowd, cheaper rent. Did you have concerns about moving in together? Rattling around in the back of my head, there were thoughts about Carter not having any real career in the works. I think I thought living together would be a good way to test out how serious he was going to get about things. Except now I can see we never actually treated living together very seriously. The fact that he worked in music made him the perfect 20-something boyfriend. His life was built around having a good time. Our lives were built around having a good time. Like many 20-somethings who cohabitate, Jennifer and Carter's life together sounded more like an intersection between college roommate and sex partner than a lifelong commitment between two spouses. They vaguely had the idea of testing their relationship, but they didn't venture into areas that typically stress a marriage. They didn't pay a mortgage, try to get pregnant, get up in the night with kids, spend holidays with in-laws when they didn't want to, save for college and retirement, or see each other's paychecks and credit card bills. Living with someone may have many benefits, but approximating marriage is not necessarily one of them. This is especially true at a time when the 20-something years are touted as a chance to have fun. Then what happened, I asked. A year or two into it, I started wondering what we were doing. A year or two, which was it, I queried. I don't know, Jennifer replied. So time was sliding also, I said. Oh, absolutely. Everything about it was fuzzy. That fuzziness ended up being the most frustrating part. I felt like I was on this multi-year, never-ending audition to be his wife. That made me really insecure. There was a lot of game-playing and arguing. I never felt like he was really committed to me. I still don't, obviously. Jennifer's fears were perhaps well-founded. To understand why, it helps to know that the cohabitation effect is technically a pre-engagement cohabitation effect, not a premarital cohabitation effect. Couples who live together before marriage but after becoming engaged, who combine their lives after making a clear and public commitment, are not any more likely to have distressed or dissolved marriages than couples who do not cohabitate before marriage. They do not suffer from the cohabitation effect. It is the couples who live together before an engagement who are likely to experience poorer communication, lower levels of commitment to the relationship, and greater marital instability down the road. Multiple studies have shown that those who live with their partners before an engagement are less dedicated before and even after marriage. This has been found to be especially true for men. A life built on top of a "maybe we will" simply may not feel as consciously committed as a life built on top of the "I do" of marriage or the "we are" of engagement. Jennifer and I started to talk about how she and Carter moved from cohabitation to marriage, a transition so full of choices and rituals it could not possibly have just happened. Marriage did not just happen, Jennifer said, rolling her eyes. I had to kick Carter's butt around the block about the ring, the date, the venue, the invitations, everything. Why did you work so hard? He hadn't turned into husband material, but our lives weren't set up for us to act like adults. I sort of assumed it would come together once we were married. You assumed that. I hoped it, Jennifer chuckled grimly. I also thought, what other choice do I have? You could have ended it. That didn't feel so easy. So much for the quick exit you mentioned, I said. It was more like quicksand, Jennifer said gloomily. Lock-in. Jennifer's reference to quicksand didn't surprise me. Sliding into cohabitation wouldn't be a problem if sliding out were as easy. It isn't. Too often, 20-somethings enter into what they imagine will be low-cost, low-risk living situations, only to find themselves unable to get out months or years later. It's like signing up for a credit card with 0% interest for the first year. At the end of 12 months, when the interest goes up to 23%, you feel stuck because your balance is too high to pay off, and you didn't get around to transferring your balance to another low-interest card sooner. In fact, cohabitation can be exactly like that. In behavioral economics, it's known as consumer lock-in. Lock-in is the decreased likelihood to search for other options or change to another option once an investment in something has been made. The initial investment, called a setup cost, can be big or small. A form, an entrance fee, the hassle of creating an online account, a down payment on a car. The greater the setup costs, the less likely we are to move to another, even better, situation later. But even a minimal investment can lead to lock-in, especially when we are faced with switching costs. Switching costs, or the time, money, or effort it requires to make a change, are more complex. When we make an initial investment in something, switching costs are hypothetical and in the future, so we tend to underestimate them. It's easy to imagine we'll just get a new credit card later, or deal with breaking a lease when the time comes. The problem is, when the time does come, the switching costs seem bigger up close than they did from far away. Cohabitation is loaded with setup and switching costs, the basic ingredients of lock-in. Moving in together can be fun and economical, and the setup costs are subtly woven in. After years living among a roommate's junky old stuff, we happily split the rent on a nice one-bedroom apartment. Couples share Wi-Fi and pets and enjoy shopping for new furniture together. Later, these setup costs have an effect on how likely we are to leave. We had all this furniture, Jennifer said. We had our dogs and all the same friends. We had our weekend routine. It just made it really, really difficult to break up. When I explained lock-in to Jennifer, she swallowed hard. When I was a teenager, I gave my mom such a bad time about staying with my dad as long as she did when she obviously wasn't happy. I understand her a lot more now. It's not easy to get out of a live-in relationship, and she had two kids to think about. I stayed with Carter because I couldn't afford to get a new couch, Jennifer cried remorsefully. Getting a new couch can feel like an insurmountable obstacle to a 20-something, I said, as Jennifer wept some more. But I'm guessing it was more than the couch. What other switching costs were there? Jennifer thought for a while and said, My age changed all the switching costs. When we moved in together, I was in my 20s. It seemed like it would be easy to move out if I wanted to. But when I turned 30, everything felt different. The switching costs of starting over after 30 felt greater, I said. Everybody was getting married. I wanted to get married. Then it was like Carter and I got married because we were living together once we got into our 30s. Getting married sooner started to feel more important than whether it would work later, I said. I'm really, really embarrassed to admit this, but I almost didn't care whether it was going to work out. I thought even if it didn't work out, at least I would have gotten married when everybody else was. I would have been on track, Jennifer sniffled. So you underestimated the switching costs, first of cohabitation and then of marriage. Definitely. Getting divorced has been a lot worse than I thought it would be. I don't necessarily regret being with Carter, but I do wish I'd never lived with him, or maybe that I'd been more willing to leave before everything went this far. Now I'm starting over anyway, in a much worse way. But you are getting out of lock-in, I reminded her. How are you doing it? I had to face facts. Carter was a great 20-something boyfriend, but he's no 30-something husband, and he's never going to be. I'm ready to grow up. My job is going well, and I want to have a family. Carter isn't ready for any of that. I don't know if he ever will be, or if he will be in a time frame that makes any sense for me. Somehow, that wasn't real or official until we officially got married. Then the excitement of the wedding was behind me. The reality of our future was all that was left. The future wasn't the future anymore. It was now. Jennifer isn't the only client I've had who's regretted moving in with someone. Some wish they hadn't sunk years into relationships that would have lasted only months had they not been living together. Others are 20-somethings or 30-somethings who mostly feel, or who want to feel, committed to their relationships, yet they are also confused about whether they have consciously chosen their mate. Founding a relationship on convenience and ambiguity can interfere with the process of claiming the people we love. We all ought to feel confident we are choosing our partners, and our partners are choosing us because we want to be with them, not because staying together is convenient or because breaking up is inconvenient. Cohabitating couples can break up and are a bit more likely to split than married couples, but many cohabitating couples, like Jennifer and Carter, don't break up. They slide from dating to cohabitation. Then they lock into marriage because getting married seems easier than dividing up the furniture and starting over, especially when friends start walking down the aisle. The more aware singles are of this, the more they can understand what living together is and what it isn't. I am not for or against living together, but I am for 20-somethings knowing that far from safeguarding against divorce, moving in with someone increases your chances of locking in on someone, whether he or she is right for you or not. There are things you can do to lessen the cohabitation effect. One is, obviously, don't cohabitate before an engagement. Since this is not an entirely realistic suggestion, researchers also recommend getting clear on each person's commitment level before you move in, and anticipating and regularly evaluating those constraints that may keep you from leaving, even if you want to. There are also other ways to test a relationship besides moving in, including doing a wider variety of activities together than dating and sex. There are other ways to figure out whether you and your partner are in love or even in like. On dating down. Conversation is to be thought of as creating a social world, just as causality generates a physical one. Ram Hare, psychologist. When Kathy was a teenager, each time she left the house, she did so underneath her mother's disapproving glare. Her mother said she needed a different outfit or a better body. Her father told her she was too much, too loud, too something. After what felt like nightly fights with her parents, Kathy fell asleep on her bedroom floor with her iPod on and her earbuds in. The next morning, she'd wake up in time to be packed off to school where things were no more forgiving. Kathy's mother was Korean and her father was white, and they preferred not to discuss race. They raised her not to see color and praised living in a post-racial society. But society and school were not post-racial for Kathy. Kathy went through high school pegged as a cultural stereotype, despite the fact she was nothing like the quiet student people assumed she was. At Kathy's Southern University, where the standard of beauty was blonde and smiley, she hardly felt noticed at all. Now a cheery elementary school teacher, Kathy dated down to an extreme. During the day, she was a dedicated professional who had published one novella for young readers and was working on a second. In the evening, she lived a somewhat different life. She never chose her boyfriends or sex partners. She let them choose her. She became involved with almost any man who showed interest. She sometimes had unprotected sex. She often responded to the 2 a.m. booty text, accepting even the thinnest excuses about why the person did not text earlier. Her attitude about any man who came along was, "This could work." When I expressed concern over Kathy's interactions with men, she dismissed me by saying, "It's just practice. The 20s are a dress rehearsal." "And look at what you're practicing," I said. "Consider what part you're rehearsing to play." "It's not a big deal," she replied, dismissing herself. But when I asked Kathy how she would feel if one day one of her little students was having these sorts of relationships, she was more circumspect. She said, "I wouldn't want that for any of the girls in my class." "Why is it okay for you?" I asked. "I mean, I know some of these guys care about me," she said defensively. "Just not enough to be my boyfriend." "That's sad," I said. "It's fine," she shrugged as she broke eye contact. I don't believe you, I said. I don't believe it's fine or that you think it's fine. The tell was that Kathy was reluctant to talk about men. I'd know nothing about the latest guy until her heart was broken. She would sanitize her description of a first date and only later let it slip that it amounted to little more than a hookup in someone's office. If she were simply enjoying her postmodern sexual freedom, then why all the secrecy? When I asked Kathy what her best friend of many years had to say about her relationships with men, she seemed confused and stammered. Nothing. I mean, she doesn't know. She doesn't know, I emphasized. No, said Kathy, surprising herself with the realization. It never occurred to me to tell her. This meant something to me. She didn't choose not to tell her best friend about her relationships with men. It never even crossed her mind. In my own mind, I flagged shame. I asked Kathy whom she'd been talking to all these years. I tell different people tiny bits and pieces. I think the full story would be too much for any one person, she said. The only completely honest conversations I have are with music. How's that? I pressed. Kathy said her iPod was loaded with angry, hurt songs. She didn't talk much about how she felt, so she listened to artists who said it all for her. Sometimes I'm riding the bus to work and I think, no one would believe the music I'm listening to right now. No one would believe what's going on in my head, she confessed. Like the iPod commercial where the silhouette of a person walks calmly down the street while the shadow dances wildly against a background wall, Kathy cruised through her 20s looking like a happy teacher while her shadow was filled with anger and despair. When I told Kathy about my association to the iPod commercial, she said that was how life felt for her, split to the point where she could not bring the pieces of herself together. Kathy feared her shadow would take over one day at exactly the wrong moment and ruin everything. But she also worried she would forever remain trapped in her pretend appearance of being happy, never truly known by anyone and unable to get out. One of the most valuable lessons I've learned as a psychotherapist was best stated by a clinician named Masood Khan. The most difficult thing to cure is the patient's attempt at self-cure. Very few lives are perfect, and because young people are generally resilient, many bounce back from difficulties with their own solutions in place. They may be outdated, imperfect solutions, but they are solutions nonetheless, ones that usually resist dismantling. A self-cure may seem harmless or subtle, such as the way Kathy soothes herself with music and men. Or it may be obviously troubling, like cutting or binging or getting high to numb out. Usually sometime during the 20-something years, life changes and the old solutions seem cumbersome and out of place. The things that once helped us feel better now get in our way. It's not okay to go to work with scars on our arms, and live-in girlfriends get tired of seeing us stoned. But we feel like we can't stop listening to the same music or hooking up for a fleeting moment of attention. A self-cure can take on a life of its own. Kathy, there's a proverb that says, a raft is a good thing to have when you're crossing a river, but when you get to the other side, put it down. Huh? For a while, music and sex helped you feel less alone, but now they are making you feel more alone. Every problem was once a solution. What am I supposed to do? Kathy asked, almost lost. I want you to stop listening to your iPod and start talking to me instead. What's wrong with my iPod? Your iPod is whispering in your ear. It was keeping you company, but now it's like a good friend turned bad, keeping you over in the corner away from other relationships where you might learn something new. It is turning your life into a dark, looping rock opera. My iPod is my friend, maybe my closest friend, Kathy said through tears. I know, but that's a problem because it can't talk back. It's just confirming every bad thing you already think about yourself and the world. You said the only honest conversations you have are with music. These are conversations you are having with yourself. I can't not listen. It's like the soundtrack for my life. It's the story of my life, Kathy said. Tell me that story. Can I give you my soundtrack? I would be honored if you did, but I won't hear the songs the same way you do. Try to tell me the story. Over some sessions, a story emerged. I didn't have a boyfriend in high school. I didn't have sex in high school. People really made fun of me for it. I grew up in this hip southern town where the kids were so cool and really wild. I felt so uncool and left out. My parents badgered me to fit in, to be part of the mainstream. I have a lot of energy, you know. I'm spirited, I like to say. My dad was always saying I was too much for everybody. He was always telling me to take it down a notch. My mom was always saying if I dressed better or lost 10 pounds, guys would like me more. But I was the Asian girl that nobody was going